back to another episode of Dealership Fix It. And today we've got Angel Hacker, who is the general manager of Indian of San Diego. And today we're going to ask her a couple questions, get to know her and see how she elevated to a position like this in the Indian brand. So welcome, Angel. Nice to have you.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Jacob.
Thank you. All right. So let's just kind of fire into the questions because I'm sure we need to get some of the background out of the way. Why don't you tell us a little bit how you first stepped into the power sports business and some of the roles that you've had within it, and then to, you know, fast forward to where you are now running your own store, general manager with the Indian brand.
Well, I've been in power sports for 11 years. I started, as a lot of people do, on the showroom floor, out there hustling, grinding, figuring out the CRM, figuring out the nine-step sales process, you know, what it feels like to sell a power sports product right on the ground floor, which I'm really, really appreciative of, because it's given me that framework that's transferred throughout the last several years, whether it's in management or counseling or just direct interaction with other operators. Those skills you develop on the showroom floor, whether you're in the web department or the sales floor, it's transferable. It stacks and builds no matter who you're interacting with. So I really enjoyed my time just being in the sales side of it. And then from there, I had an affliction towards the internet department. I thought it was really cool. And this was really early on, and we can talk about this more too, of that the web department used to be almost this mysterious department of leads just magically like came through from the website. And there was this one person that sat at a computer, sorted through them all, and just tried to get a hold of them as quickly as possible. How cool it has been to watch that department grow into what it is now, where there's entire BDCs and entire teams. And we've just developed more and more of that, you know, what is the statistic? Like 97% of our customer base now starts in the web. They start on the internet. It's not just this one weird lead that comes through the internet anymore. It's all of it. So anyway, I liked the way that they were on the phone. I liked the way that they just had the person on paper before they even interacted with them. So then as that position opened up, I jumped right for it. I was like, hey, I'd really like to take that on. I am not afraid to be on the computer. I'm not afraid of the phone. Let's do this. And really, really enjoyed growing that department. And that was when I met you. And you were doing really big things on a high level with RideNow, developing their BDC department and their web department, and getting to practice some of those new techniques that are now just standard for a lot of dealers was really cool. And then from there, I really wanted to work with Indian Motorcycle as a brand. I had it in my head. I loved working with Polaris on the off-road side. It was like, man, what if I could get into their street side? And at the time, this was when Victory was a little bit more disjointed. It wasn't part of the same network. So then when they released Indian, it became part of that RideNow network. So RideNow got to open that first Indian motorcycle dealership in Tucson. And then a position opened up in their parts and service department, which was a complete gear shift for me. Set me on a totally opposite side of the dealership, right? I went from very strong positioning in sales and learning the sales process, learning back end, web, and then transitioning over into the operation side, where I learned parts, service, time management, technicians, shipping and receiving. And I stayed there for about 5 years. And that was a great learning experience that I got to work with still to this day, some of my favorite mentors. You know, I got to work with Chris Chestnut, Phil Lombana, Matt Allen, Michael Pena, who, you know, is no longer with us, but he was a salesperson in the industry for 15 years at the time. And Mike Willits, who also just had a wealth of knowledge. And it was just cool to be in such a small shop that developed so much experience. And they all had such a colorful background and experience. And then my husband, Brad Hacker, who is also in the industry, we kind of just got to a point where it's like, we kind of want to try something new. We were both born and raised in Tucson. Absolutely love it there. But we were just ready to try something new out. And we discovered San Diego. And I just fell completely in love. Thought it was the greatest place. I was like, the weather's great. The beach is here. The desert's here. The mountains are here. Everybody rides. Everybody has recreational everything. And as things just tend to fall into place in life, as soon as we got back from a little vacation, there was an opening for Indian Motorcycle San Diego for their parts and service manager. And I connected with them, jumped right on board. And that dealership had me out here within about 45 days. We sold everything, uprooted, and came out to San Diego. And now I've been in San Diego since 2019.
Outstanding. Outstanding. You said a couple things in there that I want to touch on, right? What a beautiful trajectory, by the way, right? All the way from riding out Tucson, doing the sales, doing internet sales, up to running a parts and service division for an Indian store, and then getting your own shot to be at the number one position. I'm going to work backwards from that timeline there. And tell me about moving to San Diego, right? You said you and Brad, your husband, you both grew up in Tucson, right? You're married at this point. You're just kind of starting a life. And then you get this wonderful opportunity. What was it like for you to basically uproot a place that you were born and raised in and move, you know, to a whole nother state, California of all places, right? And start over again in a new place? That must have been scary, wouldn't it?
It was scary, but at the same time, you have to have a certain level of just trust, right? Like, trust that the calling you're receiving is the one you're meant to follow. And it's just like any big change I had, you know, coming into power sports was a big change for me. I had a career in dog training. I was a certified dog trainer and completely 180'd it and was like, I'm going to go sell motorcycles. Let's just try it. And moving to California was a lot like that, where it just felt right. The intention was there. It was aligned with where we wanted to go forward in life. And I think that was the biggest thing, is just making sure this feels right in the steps we want to take going forward in our life. And I think about that even when I'm in business or working with another dealership or another operator, of where do I want this relationship to go? And are we in line with the same goals? And it's okay if it's not, you know, staying somewhere works too. You know, it doesn't always have to be an uproot and a leave situation. That just was what I was craving and what my husband was craving and where you want to go to unlock your potential. You can't unlock your own potential until you start really leaning into those scary, resistance-filled places.
Getting out of your comfort zone.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So there's a lot of a need for power sports professionals, has been for very many years, right? And I think a lot of them are more or less scared to make that leap, right? At least something outside of the state that they're currently in. What's the best advice you can give to anybody that is kind of on the fence? Maybe they're comfortable in a position, but they want to grow, but that next opportunity is 8 hours away in another state or two states away or from one coast to another. What kind of offering advice would you give to that person?
my first piece of advice would be always find where you want to go and the opportunity will be there.
So you
find where you want to go.
You nailed down the location first.
Yeah.
I gotcha.
That was okay. Important to me.
That certainly helps. It certainly helps.
Yeah. The other thing I would say is there's no such thing as time wasted if you spent it working on something that opens you up, right? There's no such thing as time wasted if you're trying to learn something new. So even if it's a temporary thing, even if it's a, hey, maybe we go try out this job out in Seattle, or we go try out this job out in New Mexico and see what it's like to live there, go for it. Worst case scenario, dedicate the time, spend a year, 2 years, 3 years, and no one's going to ever be able to take those years away from you and the experience you gathered there. And you're going to learn new things, period. If you're going to a new place, you're going to learn new stuff that you'll be able to grow with.
That's great. That's great. So with learning new experience, right, we all learn in our own different ways. We all have our own challenges, our own opportunities in life, this journey called life. What would you say some of the most unique challenges were for you, not only in the transition from position to position, but also becoming a general manager, doing parts and accessories for Indian, and just kind of learning the back of the house, the front of the house, the digital sales, and then overall operations? What were some of the unique challenges that you faced in your career?
I would say the biggest challenge that I had to overcome and work through was going from a very established, large company that had a lot of their core values and processes established, and you were just kind of fitting into the game and the puzzle that was already created. Whereas when I got to San Diego and got to a single line, single owner, very new to the industry business, none of that was there. There was the vision, but it wasn't grounded. It was just this idea. So that challenge in itself was taking that vision and taking that idea and knowing that, okay, what are the processes I've learned so far? What are the processes that I went through in that big company that I can bring to this small company? And is it scalable? As we grow this, can it grow with the company? So that was a huge challenge of it, really isolating each and every process. You know, you don't think about just how many processes make the machine work, but it's not just that 9-step sales process. It's the, how do you log? How do you want your salespeople to log? How do you want your parts people to answer the phone? How do you want your service writers to check in each and every bike? And not just a, oh, well, I want them to do a good job. It has to be a, well, they gather this information, then this information, and then they relay these questions. They practice a YMCA, or they practice some sort of sales process, whatever works for your demographic and your team. And it's clearly replicatable to new people. That was huge and took me a long time to break down and develop.
For the folks listening to this, you brought up the sales process, the 9-step sales process, a couple other acronyms in there as well. Do you remember the 9-step sales process?
Of course.
let's hear it. The first one is greet, right?
First one's greet. Yep. Okay. Of course. You got to get your greet, and then your greet rolls into your probe, or I believe now they've rephrased it to the guided discovery, which is cool, but it means, I guess, probe might have been a little offensive to some people.
Well, probe, you're just asking questions like, what brings you in today? What kind of writing have you done? Right. Mm-hmm. It's just more or less getting rapport building, right?
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, and it's the discovery. You can get to know the person, but then you need to progress to, why are they there?
Right.
What is it there? What are the needs you're trying to solve? And then you go into the sit on, got to get them on it or in it, whatever. And
throw a leg over.
Yep. Throw a leg over. And then you have your presentation. which is a great step of making sure you highlight some featured advantages and benefits. And how does it relate to the person you just met in step one and two? That's the important connection in the steps, right? Mm-hmm. Of don't just blabber out a bunch of cool specs. What does it mean to the individual you met? What kind of connection did you make with them to discover their needs, wants, and desires to where those fabs make sense? And then from there, control, sit them down, follow me, get them to a table, get them to a desk, and then write them up. Nothing's real until you write it. And then with your write-up, you're able to work into a close, and then the close gets into the F&I, which that's kind of a funny, since we're on those two steps of the close and the F&I, so much of what I've learned is trying to get more of a full close to happen. Whereas I think there's some disconnect here across a lot of different dealerships of, do you just close on a unit, or do you close on a unit plus protection plus PG&A plus gear? Or are you closing eight different times throughout the sales process?
Did you get one yes, or did you get six yeses?
Right? Yeah. Yes. And I think there's always going to be several swings and several different closing opportunities. However, a step we kind of started implementing our dealership and even back in Tucson, and I know in a lot of the larger dealerships, this is a huge part of their dealership tour, is getting an idea of what PG&A we want to attach to the unit ahead of time. Right after that write-up step, let's start getting more right then and there. Yep. Get the PG&A ticket, get the install ticket. F&I, swing for the fence, like try to get as much approved as we can. That way, when you go out to close, you can close with a full menu of, hey, here's your PG&A you picked out. Here's a maintenance plan. Here's a warranty. Here's a paint protection. This is all rolled into payment A, B, or C. And that's that menu closing technique that I think is just extremely valuable and not talked about enough and isn't practiced enough in the dealership. And I think it's just because there's a little bit of a break between doing it that way or doing it more of the car way, which is you do a first pencil and then great, you got that first pencil closed, now you got to get it approved, and now we got to get the PG&A, now you got to get this. I like the menu process a lot better personally.
For sure, a lot more involvement in the whole process rather than get it all up front and then worry about everything else right after the commitment to buy. So let's go through those one more time. So we got one is greet, two is probe, three is sit on, which is getting them on a machine or two of them. Number four is sitting down at a table. And this is what starts the negotiation process. Oh, right.
Did you remember a presentation?
You got me. Oh. That was presentation. All right. And then you sit down and then you do the write-up, right? Now, In terms of KPI numbers, how we judge the proficiency of a salesperson and how we look at maybe some of their metrics on how well they're doing as a salesperson progressing through these steps, how much did you watch that in terms of you've got a greet to a sit down and a sit down to a write up and a write up to a close? How often were you looking at those main numbers and the relationship between those KPIs?
I think it varies on the dealership. For us, it was a data barrier that we were just starting to kind of develop and work through, but that was only because we were a really small team. You know, it was one salesperson or just the sales manager who you're monitoring, watching. However, I think it is still highly important, and comparing it to your transactional data is really, really key of, okay, how many parts tickets are we doing versus leads getting plugged into the sales CRM? And And then from there, where I really focused, at least for a small dealership, was in that how many finance apps are we getting? How many of the sit down, write up steps are we getting to? Because that, for me, especially in these smaller dealerships where you'll get a lot of repeat foot traffic, where you'll see that same customer 80 times, it starts to get a little hard to distinguish against do you log them? Do you not log them? Or like, how often do you need to log this guy?
Yep.
And I really liked the price of log him, log every time.
Yeah.
Log every single time. What, like, what, who is going to tell you, hey, you're annoyingly logging that person? Well, that person shows up a lot.
Yeah.
And you should know that. Like, you should have data that tells you that story of like, wow, Mary Jo comes in like 50 times a month. But then you now have a really great source to see who your best customers are.
A super fan, right?
Yeah, you have a super fan. But that's why I think the step tracking is really important, because then you can see, okay, well, Mary Jo's comes in 80 times a month. How is that affecting your write-up percentage? How right. many write-ups are you getting? So that is one side of it that gets a little tricky in the small shops. But again, log everybody. Log everybody.
And mark what step you're at with them when you leave them, right? Mm-hmm. So if you close it, great, job well done. And you can go all the way to step 9, or some dealerships use 10. But,
yeah.
You know, this sales step process, you know, this is 100 years old, right? I think it was developed by Ed Lemko. You and I learned this way back in the day when we were selling on the floor. Clearly, I forgot the presentation. I just want to go right to the sit down, which that's bad on me, right? This stuff is ingrained to us. But I'll try to include a link to it in this show notes or somewhere in the description, because I've got a really great graphic, right? It's, again, it's nothing new. But, you know, some of the stuff that I always watched was the same type of KPIs, but in the digital world, right? We wanted to measure and track everything and try to make it relatable as it was to this very old process that operators, general managers, sales managers knew about the floor and the showroom sales, right? They knew what a greet was. They knew what a probe was, all the way up and down this list of 9 things you're supposed to do when a customer comes into your showroom. And we tried to apply these same kind of principles to the digital customer as well, not only on the outbound side, but the inbound side too, right? So how many calls are you making? How many times are you connecting with them? Are you setting the appointments? Are the appointments showing and the appointments selling, right? There's a lot more micro conversions within those, but those are the main core of the 5 KPIs that we measure. So it's no difference in terms of the customer shopping online or the shopping that they do in the store. Well, there's a little bit of a difference, but the principles still apply on how you're progressing the customer through these steps of the buying process, right? Mm-hmm. And so it was always a fun thing to measure and track every month, because you can always pinpoint some of these deficiencies or some of these superstars just, you know, hitting it out of the park on certain metrics, but not hitting the others. And you go, look, they're right here. This is where we need to improve this technique, or we need to get more customers to the sit down. How can I help you to that, right? Or we're not closing as many deals from the write-up stage. How do we get a better closing situation in there? So always fun stuff to kind of rehash as we're, you know, in ops and doing other things now than floor selling, right?
Yeah. It gives you the opportunity to see where there's growth. It just helps you find the headroom of like, oh, okay, like if we're getting this many calls done, but we're only getting X amount of appointments and there's a deficiency in the appointment setting, well, that's great news, because now we can work on some appointment setting techniques and try some new stuff to get more appointments, which statistically will just get you more kept appointments, and more kept appointments will get you more bikes sold.
Numbers. 100%. Yeah. So moving on to this kind of brings me to the next question, right? You know, it's more of a perspective shift, right? And really, it's how has our industry, power sports, and the dealership, how have they evolved over the years? And what do you think some of the biggest trends are? And one thing you said earlier in our opening there is, when you joined the internet department many moons ago, there was always this mystery to it, right? How are these leads happening? And, you know, who's this person making all these calls? And before I let you answer, you know, the age that I grew up with the internet department, even though I was on the front lines and trying to be cutting edge and develop new things and processes, the internet department, when I looked at it from an outsider, it was always where the struggling salespeople went, right? Maybe the showroom guys that didn't get as many ups, or, you know, we're in a business where our products can hurt you. So maybe they had a hurt leg and they couldn't walk around the showroom. What do you do? What does the GM do? I'll go stick them in the internet department and have them make some phone calls, right? So it was a mix between maybe not the best sales guys, hurt sales guys, or just people who you didn't really want out on the floor interacting with customers face to face. So you put them on the phones. And, you know, that was always just such a bummer to me, because I always felt exactly the opposite about, well, you should be putting your best people in there, because you need to attract them to the showroom and get them to your showroom so you can even have a swing at selling them in person. Right. So instead you put your worst people in there. I don't know. But that's a big change that I've personally seen in trying to change that headspace in a lot of these operators' minds is, let's change out some of these individuals that are your front line and first impressions of these dealerships when they call or when they submit their lead, because you said 90%, 97% start out as an internet customer, but maybe only, you know, a portion of those have a hand raiser and they want to interact with the dealership before, right? So what are you seeing in that industry evolution?
From my perspective, at least out here in California, we get a little bit of a difference in innovation, right? And so much of that comes with, we have a plethora of super tenured, seasoned operators that have been in the industry for a long time, and they're in probably one of the most competitive markets in power sports, which is Southern California. So I've noticed two different things happening. One is this camp of salespeople are becoming the web department, where they just kind of funnel the web department to the salespeople. They say, hey, work these leads, get these people in here. And there's pros and cons of that. And then there's the other camp, which is its own machine, where you have this whole team of BDC callers, phone operators, emailers, texters that drive the traffic into the showroom. And then the showroom is presented with a sales associate or a fit that takes that person the rest of the sales process, right? And again, a couple of pros and cons on that one. To get back to the camp A, pro and con, I would say the pro of that camp is, I love the idea of the first impression person is the same person that takes them through the whole process, because you are developing a relationship. You're getting to know that person. That salesperson owns it from the beginning. So there's a lot of weight to it. There's a lot of responsibility of like, hey, this is my lead. This is my person. I'm going to follow up with them. I'm going to stick with them. The downsides, not all salespeople are created equal, which is normal. However, I think some salespeople are, you know, they're coin operated. We joke about it all the time. And I think if they don't have the right perspective of how powerful the phone and that email and that text message or that video can be on the customer themselves, they don't put full effort forth into it. You know, they look at it as an inconvenience. They look at it as an annoyance. And they could also look at it as like, it's taking me off the floor where I could just get a fresh up and sell a bike or a unit faster than spending all this time on the phone or texting or emailing. Or which I think this happened a lot during COVID, only because I even watched it in my own dealership, is you just get so caught up running around in the swirl of the retail and the people coming through the door that the email people get rushed to the side. You don't have time. You're not dedicated to just sitting there and processing that. You have all these other different hats you have to put on and spin around. So that's where it kind of opens up the pros of the separate machine of cool. Now you have people that are dedicated to getting that person back in the shop. They understand the weight and the importance of the lead itself, and they are motivated because that is all they focus on, is getting that person in the door. Now, where the disconnect is, I wish we could figure out a good combo of both camps, is once the person gets to the dealership, it's like this person they met via phone or text or email goes away, and they don't get to see that person. They don't get to interact with them anymore. Now they got this fit or this sales guy, which sometimes isn't as engaging as the web department. And that handover isn't always as smooth as I think it could be. And I think there's also still a little bit of friction from the salespeople to the web department of, oh, these people get a cut of my profits, right? Like, and every dealership does that a little differently. I don't think anybody's figured out a good pay plan structure for these businesses within the business, as I like to say, like that BDC department, how do you incentivize them appropriately to drive the best performance, but also have an appropriate pay plan for the sales guys on the other side of it? And that really brings up a good point of who is now the more important position, because I completely agree with you. The way it used to be was the web department was kind of the redheaded stepchild. It was usually a female that maybe, like you said, is physically injured, or it was a lesser performance sales guy that everybody kind of felt bad for. Like, ah, well, you can figure this out. You'll be all right over here.
Yeah.
Whereas now, you know, I look at some of the buying processes I've got to experience as a customer myself, and I had one sales girl that was my salesperson, and she was phenomenal. She was the best sales process I've ever gone through, because she emailed me every week. She would send me little text messages. This was during COVID, so it was like a pre-order situation. And it was great. And I got to go in and I got to work with her, and she got to take me through the rest of the sales steps. And it was fantastic. Whereas I think I would have been a little sad if I had lost her and like had to transfer to another person who isn't the person that's been emailing me every week and keeping me up to date on the process, and that I feel like I can hit up or call or refer my own friends or family to them. So I think there needs to be a little bit of a shift. Again, I like the camp A having the salespeople kind of in charge of them, but I almost think they need an ally.
So you were advocate of the cradle to grave in your own buying experience. So let's think about that for a moment, right? Because there's no wrong way to doing this, right? Your dealership is going to be different from the next one, and how the internal processes are combined with how you interact with a customer until that point of them coming in and now saying, okay, I'm here, right? Now what, right? Mm-hmm. So in your own experience, how many leads do you think that one particular, you know, saleswoman handled every month? How many do you think that she got to come to the showroom and then she got to sell on her own? Because the things that we don't often think about is, what's the efficiency behind that? If she's helping you, you know, with the emails and the text, she's got to do that for everybody. But up until the point of you stepping into the showroom and saying, okay, you've emailed me for a week, it was a pre-order situation, I really want to work with you. And you may spend an hour or two with that person, taking her away from the phone, away from the computer, to where she may be missing calls, missing emails that are time sensitive, because everything's always right now, right? You got to do it right now. And so what are your thoughts on that versus having these two teams for a common goal, where, like you said, one team is dedicated to the communication of all digital customers until they come to the showroom, and then that handoff happens to the specialist where he's going to do the features and benefits and basically close the rest of the deal, right? What would you prefer as an operator versus a consumer?
Consumer, I really like the cradle to grave process. Now, I do understand as an operator how that can be problematic because, you have someone who was on the computer that their primary function is answering the phone and making phone calls and being urgent, because like you said, it's all about right now. Whereas I think that's kind of where I like that ally approach of, cool, your sales guy is getting the lead, works the lead, contacts the lead. However, he also has like a backup, right? Like another person that kind of just comes in as like, as a sales advocate to like, hey, I just want to make sure everything's going great. Did you get all your questions answered? And, oh, you know what? I'm glad you called. Or, oh, I was working with so-and-so. Is it okay if I talk to you? I was like, yeah, absolutely. Almost like an assistant to the salesperson. I feel like might be a really good way to kind of start navigating it. But that only works if the sales guys are practicing the same level of skill on the phone, via email, and text. Mm-hmm. Like, there has to be better alignment between the web teams and the salespeople.
Couldn't agree more. It's a complex job, both of them. Mm-hmm. And having one person do both ends of it, that's a superstar right there. Hire that person and pay them a lot of money, because if they can do both and still perform at a high level, you've got a superstar for life for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about the crowded marketplace, right? The competitive marketplace of Southern California. As a kid growing up in Arizona myself, I always looked at California as, especially SoCal, anything from Los Angeles south to the border, right? Like, oh man, Southern Cal, SoCal is so cool. Some of the best freestyle motocross guys come out of there. A lot of race car drivers come out of there. It seems like the innovation in the sport all came out of Southern California in one form or another. Now you're there and you're kind of seeing it as someone trying to do business now in this market. It's crowded, it's competitive. Customers have a lot of options. What strategies do you think differentiated you and your store versus some of the other competitors?
I would say right out the gate, it's going to come from your customer satisfaction. It's going to come from, and it's not just always providing this out the box service. It's more of the, it goes smoothly. Everybody knows what they're talking about. There's a level of deeper connection. And that for me, and I think that can be scalable to any size dealership. You just need each person on the team to be on the same page of, there's something very valuable to recognizing Kathy when she walks through the door as the person you sold a Razor 4 XP to. And hey, how's it going, Kathy? And just that, just being able to remember a name and care a little bit deeper about their recreation, what they're into, what they do for a living. It's the format, right? That is the differentiator for sure in this crowded market. Because the other side of it is, there's so many people. There's so many people coming in and out that it becomes very easy to be just a number and you're just a transaction. Where if you can establish with your customers that they're not, and that you legitimately care about why they're there and what they're looking for, you will have a career in this industry no matter where you go, whether it's sales, parts, or service, or management. It won't matter because you legitimately hear what people are telling you, you absorb it, and you retain it as important information. Their name is important information. And I think any sales manager or manager in general would support me in saying nothing makes you more mad when a salesperson comes in with a write-up with no name on it. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
What's his name? Worst answer ever. Turn around, leave, go get their name and listen to it, hear it, absorb it. Don't just go through the paces. And it's hard because you get caught up, right? You get excited, especially when it's like, maybe it's been dead. It's been slow. You haven't had anything going on. You just need to make paycheck. You start getting in your own head and getting in your own way of being productive and successful, which it's not about you. Get to know your customer legitimately, and they will feel it. They feel it and they understand. And then you'll get the reviews. And as you get the reviews, you'll get the referrals. And the referrals are a guarantee way that you'll continue to get business. And I know that's not just true for Indian. I know that's true for any manufacturer. Of as you continue to gain that trust and they feel comfortable there, it's a game changer. You know, I think to a new friend of mine that just started running San Diego Harley. He's a fantastic operator. That shop is a beautiful dealership that just had some misalignment on management. And as soon as Josh got in the door, it was all about positive mentality. It was all about feeling good. He dropped his office down into the showroom. It was like, my door's always open. I'm right here. I bring the energy and we care. And all of a sudden, all of these other groups and writing groups are like, oh, like this is a safe place for us to come to and have community. And sometimes that just comes with remembering why we do what we do, why people buy recreational vehicles. They don't need anything, right? We're taught that pretty early on. Nobody
for sure
needs anything we're selling. However, they want that community. They want that place. You know, you don't buy a razor because it's going to increase your stock values. You buy a razor because you get to go out to Glamis every Halloween and rage with all of your friends and family, and you look forward to seeing these same dozen people that you see every time you go out in the desert, and you love bringing it into the shop and meeting your service writer and checking in with them. And the parts department always has cool new stuff that you get to try on and put on your unit. Like, that's the side of it that gets so easily lost in all of the processes and the steps and the how do we do this. It's like, just get back to basics. Get to know your customer. It's that step one and step two. They're the most important.
Get to know why they're there, right? I always used to make an analogy to people that I would come across in trainings, and I go, you know, we're not selling pots and pans, right? Or even if you want to link power sports to automotive, even though they're the same type of, you know, business with sales, service, and parts department, you're selling vehicles and registration and title and financing, right? Two very similar businesses, but it's not the same type of transaction, right? You know, you don't buy a Toyota Corolla to go hit the dunes or to go cruising with your buddies in your Nissan Sentra. No, you're going to work. It's a thing that you need to live and do life. To your point, our products can go, you know, can go months without riding them, right? Or a person can go their entire life without throwing their leg over a motorcycle. So it really takes that special relationship building to kind of help educate them, not only in the first bike, but their second and third and their fourth, right? And so that's what makes it so niche, is that, you know, we sell fun. We sell fun, we service fun, we accessorize fun. It just so happens our products that we sell provide that fun. And so as long as you're kind of with that mindset of these people want our products, they don't need them, I think it gets you a little bit better, you know, into that customer psyche a little bit more, and almost kind of makes them trust you a little bit more, and just kind of, okay, what do you recommend? Because I need a helmet and I need a jacket, and which bike should I go, right? Because a lot of these guys are lost at the very beginning of this riding journey that they're set about, right? Mm-hmm. So good stuff. So that customer approach, right? That was your big, you know, this is what we do in a crowded market. We got to be more personalized. We got to have more community. What was your approach to be that, right? For everybody listening right now, they're all going to agree with you. They're going, yeah, take care of the customer, right? Duh. Right. But for a high level operator such as yourself, how did you do that? What steps, what training, what processes did you have to put in front of your people to say, this is how we're going to accomplish that goal?
That's actually a beautiful question. And that for me really came down to, it becomes very hard to focus on the customer when your head is going so many different directions. So my whole goal was always to make, how do we make your job as easy and simple as possible so you can focus on that relationship that you need to be focusing on? Because otherwise you're not going to be able to. So a huge thing for me, and this really came to light in the operations side of the house, because I think that's a side of the house that struggles the most to get it, because there's so much going on. Anybody that's worked in parts or service, it's the hardest department in the house. You have constant fires. You constantly have the phone ringing. There's never really much time to think. And the other side of it is, you're not always dealing with customers on their best day. You're usually dealing with them very upset. So the approach I really took, which was just taking what helped me be able to accomplish it, is like, okay, I know what I need to do each and every customer. It's written down. There's a form, there's a track, there's a process that I can focus on that makes that relationship building not so scary and not so overwhelming of like, how am I supposed to care about John and his wife and his family if all I can think about is the swing arm that's broken in the back and John keeps calling me every 10 minutes screaming at me? Like, you don't write down their name and number. Cool, we got that fixed. Hey, what brings you in today? Cool, get all that information. Let's go take a look at the unit. And this isn't just winging it. It's, you do that every single time of follow that step. And being aware of where the team finds friction. If you're noticing, or just ask them, what is it in your day that would make it difficult for you to make a relationship with a customer? And I'm sure they'll give you like five reasons right off the top of their head. They probably don't have to think very much about it. And I think this is true for any dealership, because every dealership is having the same problems. It's just a matter of identifying them so you can then solve them. So one, for example, is it's really stressful to schedule service appointments of like, okay, well, let's make a framework of how do we schedule a service appointment? And this is going to be standardized for the dealership. So it doesn't matter who's doing it. We answer the phone, we get their info, we find out what they're trying to get done. We schedule waiting appointments in this time slot and drop off appointments in this time slot and make sure that we're checking the standard repair times to know how much time this appointment is going to require, and add a little bit for upsell. So you're not so stressed out. You have a little bit of time, and just having that set up releases this pressure off a service rider to now like, oh, okay, their appointment has the appropriate amount of time. I can see it ahead of time. I can prepare for it ahead of time. I know who's already coming in. So when they show up, I know who they are. I know what they ride. I know what they're here for. I have ammo. I have tools that make that relationship building smooth and comfortable. That was always my first thought whenever I would approach an issue, is how can I make this easy? How can I make it easy for the team and make it easy for the consumer? Because it has to be both. It can't always just all be about making it easy for the customer, because then you can kind of end up in this really scary discount spiral and nobody has any control and customers just come in and demand these crazy, outrageous things and your team is just powerless. Whereas if you focus on both of, okay, how can I make this easy for my team members to actually be able to walk through each step themselves comfortably, and giving them support of, hey, what do I do when a customer does this? Or what do I do when a customer just refuses to follow the process that I have as a team member? Like, okay, well, let's give you some tools and tips to manage difficult customers, because really a lot of this is just controlling the situation, controlling that it's your house. You can guide that step together and then everybody feels great, because customers want to feel that. They want to know that their product's being taken care of and that they're working with a professional. Nobody wants to walk into a place and see everybody running around with their hair on fire and stressed to the gills. They want to come in and be like, smiling faces, and oh, everybody looks happy and comfortable because they know what they need to get done.
That's great. That's great. And so when you're in the mode of developing these processes and, you know, you're setting the vision for the store and for the staff and saying, this is what we need to do, here's how we need to do it, did technology play any part in building this process with you in terms of gathering data or just having it in a dashboard or some type of, you know, CRM where you can keep track of all these various different issues that these customers are having and really give you a game plan to know how to handle them when they come in? How did that play a part?
I think that's a huge thing that's happening in the industry right now, is incorporating more technology, because we're discovering more technology. I use quite a bit of technology when it comes to setting up processes and organization. And I mean, just the fact that you can make sure everyone on your team has an email and everybody has access to certain documents that are transparent to everyone on the team is huge, right? And then that way you can limit the back and forth. I have to go ask this person or go ask that person. And it's all visible. It's all there. I love the idea and the practice of no silos. Don't compartmentalize information to where nobody can get to it. Keep it open for everyone on the team so you can all work towards the greater good. So I would say one of them is, it would just kind of come up naturally of, we would isolate the problem, find the problem, and then, okay, well, how can we make something that solves this for us? So a huge one that I developed that I really think is huge is having a scoreboard of, cool, everyone on the service team can see and understands what their efficiencies are, proficiencies are, and productivities are. And it's visible to everybody on the team. And using reports out of your DMS system to plug in that data, understand how it gets there, and then everyone can kind of work together to improve those metrics, because everyone wants to win. Nobody wants to show up to work and do a bad job. They want to be able to see if they're winning or not. So technology really came into play with that of just the overall management of performance and metrics, because that's how you can tell you're doing a good job, is by those metrics and having good technology in place. Just in the shareability is huge. You know, Google Drives, use the technology that we have. It's really valuable.
What do you think about some of these dealers now investing in building their own technology to help with some of their vision and some of their goals?
I think it's been a long time coming, to be honest. I've always kind of joked that this industry's been a little archaic of like, oh, you're still using like a old school like calendar for scheduling with a pencil? Like, oh, that's a lot more work than it could be. And yeah, there's so many cool scheduling tools that now that make you better with time management. And so I'm really excited to see what comes out of more and more of these dealerships investing in their own technology, because I also feel like a lot of the technology that's currently available isn't dealership made. It isn't made by people that have been in the weeds. It hasn't been developed by individuals like yourself that know what the struggles are, because that's a huge part of developing the process, right? Is you have to be able to be flexible and pivot and adapt to, as when you and your team develop this, okay, here's our plan, here's our process, here's our steps. Okay, you're gonna have to make changes, probably a lot of them, because you're going to discover holes that you didn't see right out the gate. You're going to find these, oh, well, we're noticing that when the unit gets sold and then the service department gets a notice that the unit is sold, it's not communicating to the parts department what parts need to be installed. So we're thinking the unit's ready to go and it's all prepped and safetied and out in the front parking lot. And then the sales guy and the customer walk out to the unit and then they're like, oh, where's my handlebars? And then it's like, oh, well, we need to incorporate that somewhere in our process of, hey, now this ticket jumps over to the parts department before it's complete. So then parts can catch things and have multiple sets of eyes on it. And all that just comes with being able to pivot and adapt and not setting a step process and not being willing to make changes to it. You really got to be able to make changes and adjustments. And I think that's going to come into play with some of these new technologies of, hey, let's see what they do, how they work. And as time goes on, we're probably going to find some faults and some issues that need improvement. And we will make those adjustments and faults. And the beauty of where the industry's at right now is there's more and more people like yourself that are younger, that have been in technology since the inception and watched as other industries discover these automations and they discover these better tools for customer interaction and time management. And I wonder how we can incorporate some of those technologies into power sports that, like I said, I feel has been very archaic for a while now. So it's going to be exciting.
If let's say you had a magic lamp and the genie comes out and he says, Angel, whatever your problem is, we're going to solve it with technology right now. What would you say is the biggest deficiency, the biggest problem, the biggest black hole that you have not been able to fix with processes yet that you think technology would? What's the number one thing?
The first thing that comes to my mind is marketing.
Marketing. Okay. In what way?
In a couple of different ways. You know, I think marketing is a beast all in itself that a lot of operators and a lot of principals don't necessarily have the background in.
But they all love to do. They all love to mingle and tinker with the marketing, even though they might not have a background in it, right?
Correct. Yes. And I think it tends to cause some problems that maybe weren't even there to develop to begin with. It can be a huge hit on expenses. It can become a money pit. And that was an area that I know as an operator, I felt very blind to of, is because I didn't have the background in SEO, and search engine optimization is just something that, unless that's your education privately outside of a dealership, it's not really talked about that much. And then when you listen to certain teachings and podcasts on it, it's very rudimentary, or it's too little, or it's like, okay, well, I get Facebook. But how does a dealership sit down and strategize their target audience and have an AI type system just take what they know of, hey, I know I'm in this location and I want to target these zip codes for these age brackets and these income levels. These are the people I want my content getting to. And that AI system and technology can just take what they actually know and be like, cool, do this.
A lot of people would argue that it was almost that easy up until the last Apple update, which removed a lot of those, personal tracking metrics that our phones keep on us, right? And a lot of people thought that was great for, privacy, which it is. And I know California has kind of been on the leading edge with this, with the CCPA and all those laws that they passed about, consumer protection. But it really has done a number on our marketing, being able to deliver the right messaging at the right time to the right customer. That's the holy grail of any marketing in whatever platform or vertical you want it in, right? But that has made it increasingly difficult to deliver that. There used to be ways that you can build an audience based on time or interest level that was damn near accurate, right? If you're looking or even talking and the phone's in the room with you and it might hear that you're interested in something, the old adage is that all of a sudden you'll start seeing ads or, display banners on the websites you visit for the dog food that you were just talking about or the shoes that you wanted to buy, right? And right. we were almost there for a lot of our marketing for motorcycles. It's just a little bit longer of a life cycle, if you will, right? People need dog food every month or shoes every couple months. It's a few years in between purchases with motorsports, right? So let's talk about that a little bit more and go down that path with you. The marketing you wish it can solve with your wish with more technology. Is it an expense thing? Is it a getting a broadcasted message, to more masses or to be more kind of sniper where you're delivering a personalized message? What would you say was your biggest wish in the marketing arena?
I would say better data transparency, I think it's very difficult, at least it was for myself, to quantify the spend you're doing with marketing to what is actually coming out of it. And I think that just comes with, there were so many different impressions in the way that different marketing groups and marketing providers define an impression to a click to actual lead retention. And knowing if what you're doing is good enough or strong enough, or if you're just spinning your wheels and throwing money out into the ether, or if it's like, oh, okay, like we spent this amount on this campaign and we were able to generate this many impressions, this many clicks. And I know a lot of groups are really good about this, that they are getting cleaner and cleaner data out of it. I just think, to your point, that the industry of marketing moves so quickly that it seems like right as we start to get it figured out and that there's some actual data to use, it changes again. So the keeping up with the speed in which marketing is growing has been an interesting thing to watch from this industry.
In digital marketing, it's certainly a great equalizer, right? If you're knowledgeable about it, or you hire the right kind of people to do this work for you, or even some of these larger agencies that are able to deploy a lot of these campaigns in all these different areas, like you said, it certainly makes a difference in it, rather than trying to do it all on your own, right? Mm-hmm. Did you have an agency that you collaborated with at least once a month, twice a month?
Yeah, we worked with a couple of different groups. One of them that I really enjoyed working with was Power Sports Marketing. Just because they were very industry focused. They provided a lot of tools that you could use yourself. And again, it was very collaborative of like, hey, what do you got going on? What would you like to target? And they were really good about the technology that they were currently using. Of like, oh, okay, we have dynamic retargeting, we have web tracking, we have these kind of expansive databases where we can target some people that aren't currently on your list that are fitting within your demographic as best as can be done given the certain regulations and kind of roadblocks that you can run into. But yeah, I really liked working with those guys.
And which one of the channels that they offered this advertising in do you feel worked best for you, your dealership, your area, and your product?
I would say the most productive thing that we would have is they had something called a sharpshooter, which was like a very focused marketing campaign that you would kind of design with them that was sort of like a massive triple threat, right? Where you'd get a giant e-blast, you'd get a phone call blast, and then it would prompt every receiver to kind of complete a little survey. And it was kind of a fun survey rather than just a, hey, do you want to buy a bike or not? It was like, hey, what are you excited about? The tacos, the new apparel, what bike do you want to ride? So it was a really engaging. And then that would be paired with a mailer. So it just really hit all of the buttons right in a row. Now, the downside, which I'm sure this is just kind of that comes with marketing, is that can be a little expensive. And depending on how many events your dealership is doing, that can get a little costly over a period of time. So as like a single line dealer, I was kind of finding that a good reasonable budget with it was like a sharpshooter a quarter, whereas like a larger dealership that's running a lot of events, and again this goes into what your competition looks like here in California, running events and doing things to bring customers to your location gets very competitive because everyone's doing something. It's very hard to get people's attention here because there's so much going on. So really having events pretty often is important for these areas that are very competitive. So having the sharpshooter paired with those events, I noticed a significant difference between the events we had paired with sharpshooters versus events that were just, hey, we launched them, we put them on Facebook, we put them on social media, we sent our own little newsletter, but it didn't quite have that same impact of the multiple hits.
You saw a big difference with the agency doing these multi-pointed, you know, launches with direct mail, e-blast, social media, Google, you know, the huge broadcasting just for that one event. Mm-hmm. What was your typical response rate on some of these fun surveys that they put out there on the tacos or the beer night or whatever it said, right? It was kind of fun. What was your typical response rate on that?
Pretty high. We would get anywhere between like 40 to 60% response rate, which from what I've understood was pretty strong. Whereas, like a regular blast or reach out doesn't necessarily get that sort of traction. We'd be in like the 20, 30%.
Now you've got this response rate, right? Which is better than industry norms, what would you do with these responses? Would you deliver them a secondary message or do phone outreach? What was your follow-up to that?
Then we would take the responses that we got and push them into the sales department. And my sales guy would just go through and text everybody and call everybody and just make that personal connection to them. And then we got great response that way too, because then they were already kind of prepared for it. And we actually got a lot of positive feedback on the marketing too, of like, wow, this was really nice. Like I did wouldn't have known about it otherwise, especially with the mailers, because I think they're kind of an old school way of doing things, but it's still effective. And I think that's just because we still have a lot of customers in that generation that don't check their email or don't spend hours on social media. They check their mail. And that was a really cool piece of marketing that I think is still very effective with our market.
I agree. As much of a digital marketer that I want to be, right, and be all things digital and be on the latest trends and topics and platforms, I see the numbers too. Mail still works. It has to be a component, not just, you know, the only thing you do is mail. But if you, like you said, group this with a couple other things going on and launch them all together, the numbers in the mails, right? They you got a large list that you can afford to send a nice, you know, letter or glossy two-sided type of announcement. And you get a lot of responding out of that, right? Yeah. Or a lot of people at least showing up holding it, right? Hey, I got your mail piece. Where's my hot dog, you know, for the event, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit more about the events and then we'll kind of wrap it up. So events are huge in our business, right? For everything that we've talked about so far on this episode, it was all customer centric, right? How do we make a better mousetrap with keeping the customer happy and coming back? We talked about technology, we talked about processes, service and parts, and kind of getting everything organized, all for the benefit of the people that keep the lights on, which is our customer. If they stop buying our products and servicing their vehicles with us, we don't have a career, right? So tell me about the events, because that's the fun stuff everybody kind of likes. There is almost two parties to it, right? When you look at the staff that puts on the events, which is typically your sales staff, some guys love it, right? This, and I'm talking about the sales staff. They love it and they're happy to be a part of it and, you know, be the grill master that day or go put, you know, the easy ups out on the parking lot and blow up a bunch of balloons and put out the big inflatable, wacky, waving guy, right, on the corner of the street. And then there's the other guys that go, oh, not another event. We never sell anything. These customers are only here for the free food and to listen to the band and, you know, ask me questions, but I sell nothing those days. As an operator, as a salesperson, you've had a long, very successful career in the dealership in many capacities. What's your overall feeling about these events?
I can relate to both those people. And I think that all just comes down to the quality of execution of the event. If you're not putting good marketing effort forth and you don't have a good plan of how that event's going to go and what the call to actions are that the customers are going to be coming to you with, and your team doesn't have a good plan of how to react to these people at this event, you're going to have a bad event and your staff's going to be annoyed. They're going to be overworked. There's going to be too much pressure and they're going to have like a meltdown. I have watched and experienced and been a part of really wonderful events and really not wonderful events that were a nightmare and like, oh my God, like, I think we just lost money all day. So I do understand how that mentality gets there. But I do think it is stemmed from the overall execution of the event. And that really came down to giving your team really clear reasons why we're having the event. You have to have a good why. The why for your event can't just be, well, we're going to cook some burgers and people are going to show up and it's going to be busy. That's not going to work.
We posted it on Facebook.
Yes, yeah. We posted it on Facebook. There has to be the purpose of this event is demo rides, right? We want to get butts in seats. We want to get them riding the bikes. We want to get them excited about the bikes. And then from there, we want to be able to help connect them to bikes, find them the perfect bike. And then having some call to actions in place of like, hey, this weekend only, we have this special PG&A package that we're going to attach to everybody who is purchasing a bike. So you could take advantage of some cool incentives we have going on. And giving your team some sort of weapon like that, of like, okay, I know I'm going to lean on this as I'm talking to these people at this event. And staying focused is huge with events of like, okay, you don't spend all 4 hours of your day with the one guy that's just there to eat all the free hot dogs and hamburgers. Like, keep rotating, keep moving, make yourself very available, and not be afraid to do a little bit of juggling where you maybe wouldn't normally. You would want to just stick with that one person and guard them and protect them of, oh, like, okay, like rotate them through, set up, and having your dealership set up appropriately of like, okay, we have multiple tables, we have multiple seating areas, we have spots where we can follow that sit down step, drop somebody somewhere and be like, cool, you got a drink, you got a beverage, great, I'm gonna run these numbers real quick, I'll be right back, keep them entertained. And then same with the entertainment throughout the dealership of like, everything can flow together so you don't have so much chaos in the event happening.
Totally, totally. Yeah. Tell us about your best event. Maybe not the most successful. Which one do you think was your best that you had the most fun or turnout to?
I would say personally for me, the best event we had was the Medicine Wheel Ride in 2021. It was right kind of in that cusp of COVID where we were still wearing masks, but not all the way. And events were just now coming back. So we hosted a Medicine Wheel Ride, which was a ride to support and bring awareness to Indigenous women and how that they can go missing and not be brought to media attention. And they're just kind of the lost sisters of the Indigenous people. So it was a really, really beautiful cause. And it brought out this huge group of people and, you know, chaos at its best, for sure. We had tattoo artists, we had people out in the parking lot that were BYOB, they were bringing beers in their saddlebags. We had food and music and all the things going on. And in all of that, you know, every staff member just had their focus of like, okay, here's my focus. I'm sticking with focusing on the apparel, or the salespeople were focused on working on the showroom floor and answering questions and presenting units and keeping that rotation going and not getting too caught up in the chaos of everything and still having a ton of fun. And that was a really cool event that I think we ended up selling a few bikes that weekend, which always feels good when you can leave an event knowing like, okay, we made some action, people took home some bikes. And you know, at worst case, you always want to know that you loaded the pipe, right? Like, okay, yep. I have, if they didn't purchase today, because sometimes it is a lot. And I've had customers before that are, it's like, this is too much. I can't handle like a big decision while all this is going on. They get like overdosed of dopamine where it's like, okay, cool. Like, let's bring it down. Let's get all the information. Let's get your app, like, and let's schedule an appointment, get you back in here, make it easy, put a deposit. That way you kind of are able to lock them in and set your week up for business and success off of that one event.
That's so cool. So cool. And that was all your planning, all your strategy, all your vision, and putting it together?
Very much a collaboration. It's very much working with like a marketing manager and working with people in the IMRG group and having them take on tasks. A lot of delegating has to happen to make an event successful, of and isolating all of the things that need to be done and breaking that up by person. Like I said, having everybody have their set tasks is huge. Of, okay, here's my job during this event, and helping make sure everybody has support through that and being able to kind of just orchestrate from there.
That's so great. That's so great. Delegating and managing everybody. So we've talked for a little while now. I think we've almost hit the 45 minute mark. And I want to part with one last question.
Okay.
I came into this from automotive. I came up as a technician working on cars, sold cars. I've been in dealerships, my entire career, and just, you know, kind of working through those positions within the automotive dealership, and then getting this wonderful opportunity to step into power sports and just accelerating into hyperdrive, my love for the sport, because I was an enthusiast coming into it going, wow, I really kind of got this business figured out from the back of the house to the front of the house. It's kind of the same stuff, but now power sports, I love this stuff, right? But I didn't have the early introduction to it like a lot of people have had, right? A lot of people have been 20, 25, 30 years into the power sports industry, but you know, these guys are already excelled to a level that is running a store or a high level GSM or GM like yourself. For the first timer, right, that's coming into it, maybe they're a little unsure. The industry definitely needs a lot more people to help drive it forward. You know, we need more professional people from different backgrounds, people that have had experience in the sport. What's the advice that you would give to someone that is interested in getting involved in the power sports industry, either as, you know, an owner wanting to buy a shop, or just, you know, an entry level employee wanting to sell bikes when they're just starting out?
What I would really like to start seeing more is the leaders in this industry kind of stepping forward and creating intern programs, working with their local high schools. We did a wonderful program with High Tech High, which is a high school here in Southern California, where they have a intern program that you can sign your business up for, and you would have to look in your general area to see what's available. But we took on 3 different teenagers as full-blown 5 to 6 weeks. They came to work 5 days a week, bell to bell, and they just learned. They were interns, so it was of no cost to us as a dealership other than sharing our time and our knowledge. And all 3 of those teenagers are still in the industry and still building their careers and fell in love with it. And we're just given the opportunity, right? So I think that would be the first thing, is if you're a leader in the industry and if you have the means to invite others to learn from you and your team, it also will revitalize your team. My technicians loved the whole time, because they had this kid that just thought they were the coolest thing ever. They were like, this guy works on motorcycles for a living. He knows everything about motorcycles. And how cool does that get to feel, of, oh wow, like this young person really looks up to me and I can show them something. And it just, it's such a great energy to bring into the industry, because I think it has been very scary in the past. Mm-hmm. I think walking into a Harley Davidson dealership as someone that doesn't ride Harleys is probably one of the scariest things you can do. Like, nobody looks like you. Everyone's dressed kind of scary with their big rings and tattoos and flannels. And, you know, it's that motorcycle. And there's just big personalities in dealerships that can be really scary. So being more receptive and inviting people into our space and like, hey, you can learn this. Hey, you can jump in on this. And I think the other thing I would like to just share as advice is don't let it scare you because maybe you look a little different than people in that dealership, that you absolutely can still do it too. Just because you don't see a lot of females or people that look like you doing it doesn't mean that you can't. And just try it. Like, just jump in and give it a go. Even if it's, you don't even have to start riding right away. Because I think that's a misconception, is people are like, oh, you have to know how to ride, or you have to have grown up with motorcycles and off-road to jump into this. And it's like, no, not really. Not really at all. You just gotta actually like people and talking to people, and you'll start to understand why they're into what they're into. And then you may discover for yourself this passion or this community. And then before you know it, you'll probably have a motorcycle in your garage, or a Ranger, or a jet ski, or something that speaks to you, all because you discovered this way of making a living that's truly exciting and rewarding. And I don't think enough people give it the credit it deserves, or a chance that, hey, you can have a lot of fun doing this.
They catch the bug and it breeds a whole nother generation of riders and enthusiasts. I love it. I love it. All right. So what did we learn today? We learned that Angel is at the peak of her career, killing it in Southern California, selling lots of bikes, making processes. And this comes from a long history of professionalism within the parts department, within the internet department, the sales department, learning it up from the ground level all the way to where she is now. She's corrected me on my 9-step sales process. Thank you for that. And she's just killing it out there. So what's the next step for Angel? Where do we go from here?
Next steps for me, I am really, really feeling into this calling to help and drive more for other operators and for other dealer principals, and really getting into that saying, the rising tide raises all ships, is I want to be able to pull myself out of just a single dealership and be able to help several and be an advocate for them and help them through a lot of their struggles. So that's some of the stuff I'm working on right now, is developing some tools and tips and counseling with other operators and other owners that just need somebody that's got their back. That's something I've always cherished and needed during my time operating and my time coming up through the industry, is having someone that you can have a discussion with, that you can bounce some ideas off of, or someone you can just call when you're having a rough day or things are just spiraling out of control, that you can simplify with and be like, let's get back to the basics. Let's go back to our processes. Let's find a way to reframe what's going on so you can be happy and productive. Because at the end of the day, this is a fun industry and we should all be happy doing it at any level. And I think more operators could use the support and use the help.
Well, hopefully they will find this podcast and pick up a few little nuggets that we talked about today and continue to listen to more of our episodes and just really kind of get a good reassurance that they're not alone out there. There's people out there providing value for the masses, free of charge. We can talk to them. We can help them with some of the things that we've learned and certainly our experiences that we had, and just help guide them a little bit. I'm totally with you there. So thank you, Angel. And thanks for everybody listening. We'll catch you next time.
Yeah. Thank you, Jacob.